Well, the world is a dumpster fire, nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good, and you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today it might actually be more like one cup of tea at a time. Today's guest is tea maker, author, actress, and human trafficking survivor, Amanda Blackwood. Now, I'm going to tell you right up front, I sometimes do trigger warnings on these things for a reason, and today would be a real good one. If you've got some issues in or around abduction, assault, just be warned. There's some pretty intense stuff coming, but I don't want that to scare you away, because this is a great conversation. We managed to have some laughs. You know, when people who have been through some stuff, and I don't mean to compare myself to what she's been through, mind you, but when two people get together and they've been through some stuff and they kind of, you know, they kind of compare their war wounds, sometimes you laugh because look what I lived through. Look what I survived. How ridiculous is it that I came out the other side of this and I'm still up and walking around? I think it's only natural to sometimes find the humor in things if you find your way to the other side of healthy on it. That's my opinion on it. But I'll tell you what, speaking of finding your way to the other side of healthy, I've been having some strange things happen with the advent of starting a medication. And as some of you know, if you listen to the last episode, I've started a regimen of Lexapro after not being on any kind of medication for the past 15 years. Now, the significance of that is that I am bipolar 1, and typically you don't want to give that antidepressant to a bipolar person because they need a mood stabilizer. But I declined the mood stabilizer because I kind of want to ride the coaster, you know what I mean? I don't know how healthy that is, but I'll tell you what, I am feeling pretty great. I feel like I can trust my emotions again for the first time in forever, but that has also thrown a great big wrench into my usual works, because now that I feel like I have a handle on my emotions and, whether or not they're valid, whether or not I'm right to be happy or sad or upset about something, it's kind of digging up some things that I got wrong and placing them into question. More on that in a minute. First, I want to do something. I don't get to do this often enough on the show. Today's guest gave me a copy of her latest book, and I was really excited to get it because I've got the others, and this one's a book of poetry, and I wanted to touch upon a poem that I liked quite a lot. And this is called Art. When you look at a work of art, you see the beauty and the color it holds. Every crease, every line, every scar makes it more beautiful. When an artist looks at the same work of art, he will only see the flaws and what he wishes he could have done better. Wishes he could fix the complex flaws. Wishes he could start over. You are a work of art. You are. Believe in that. You are perfect just as you are. Take back your control and do what makes you feel beautiful. Because you are. Now, I found that to be very appropriate for me. because that's definitely how I'm feeling lately. I've done the work as far as learning how to live with suicidal thoughts and things of that nature, but, you know, there was always some kind of an undercurrent of sadness going on inside me, a little bit of darkness. And I found a way to make peace with it. It didn't go away, but I found a way to, you know, give it its own space away from the rest of me. But it was still there. And now that it seemed to have retreated, I guess you could say, I did have a strange suicidal thought the other day. It kind of came to me. As I was thinking things over sort of logically, and I realized that you can have suicidal thoughts without being sad or depressed. You know, if it's wired in you, if you wire it in yourself, if you allow it to occupy the space, it will. I still have some things to learn. And looking at that poem made me think of some things. It made me realize that I beat myself up a little more often than I should. It's something I'm still trying to figure out how to stop myself from doing. And I've been doing some meditation. I've been, trying to be more mindful and just a better person in general. And this poem, I don't know. I think it helped. I think art has the power to help. And I should stop beating myself up over it. Anyway, I think you're going to have a really good time with the conversation that I had with Amanda Blackwood. And without further ado, here's my conversation with the amazing Amanda Blackwood. All right. So hi.
Hi.
How's it going?
Woo! Fabulous.
It's really interesting always to talk to someone that I've so many questions about, and you've got kind of a crazy story.
Yeah. Several.
Yeah, I'm sure. Not the least of which is the fact that we're drinking tea that you made.
Yes. Yeah.
Which we can start there, actually, because I have I have so many questions about that. What makes a person decide I'm going to make tea?
Well, it came about because I'm a big tea drinker. Always mm-hmm. have been. At one point, I had over 40 different types and varieties of teas in my house. Mm-hmm. Recently, I couldn't find a particular flavor that I was looking for, so I decided to make it. And all of my friends started asking me, well, where can I find it? Because that sounds really good. I want to try it.
Yeah.
So I started sharing it and letting them try it. And eventually, they kept on telling me that I needed to start selling it, and they were offering to buy it from me. So I started making it in bulk, and then I started selling it. 50% of the profits that I make off of every box of tea that I sell go to organizations here in Colorado that fight human trafficking.
That's amazing. I mean, that's really amazing. Not the least of which, I mean, you have a history with human trafficking.
I do.
That is not something that I think most people will ever come close to in their lifetime, at least in a way that they're familiar with.
Right. There's a lot of
I mean,
of
educate
gray area
me a little, because I know I know only a little bit, like, you know, from what I learned in college,
right,
and things like that. But I mean, why don't you tell me?
Well, it is the second most profitable industry in the world, bested only by drugs, mm-hmm. And there is a lot of overlap in these two arenas. A lot of times, the girls are drugged. Or mm-hmm. boys are drugged in yeah. order to be taken or coerced. It's the average age for a child in human trafficking is between the ages of 12 and 14. And the average lifespan of a child in trafficking is only 7 years. At that point, they are beaten to death. Mm-hmm. They are murdered. They commit suicide. It's any number of things, but they don't live past that 7 years. So if you think about it, a 12, 13-year-old kid probably not going to make it to the legal drinking age.
Yeah. Yeah, that's incredibly intense to think about. And so there's got to be, an awfully steep road to recovery after going through something like that.
Yeah.
So let's go back even farther. Let's take it all the way back. Where did you grow up?
My dad was military. I grew up everywhere. So I was born in Germany. Nice. We moved to Maryland, Arkansas, California, Utah. When I left, I started running away when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up in the most supportive of households, and some would call them rather abusive. And I started running away at about 15 years old.
Yeah.
By the time I figured out where I was going to land, I ran away with four other kids. I actually talk about that in another one of my books called The Miller Miles. And it shows how I was introduced to a lot of things that are involved with human trafficking and child pornography. A 13-year-old little girl was sleeping with a 22-year-old man while we were on this road trip. It took us 4 days to go from northern Utah down to Phoenix, Arizona. It was brutal. It was not an easy thing to see or to live through or try to ignore what's happening next to me.
Was that just like, you know, your currency for passage? I mean, was that how that went?
No.
Or was that just sort of like...
She was convinced she was in love with him and he had a thing for little girls.
Yeah. Yikes.
Yeah. That's all it was.
Yeah. You know, and that's the thing, too. I think that there are probably situations that people can put themselves in where, like a guy like that, I can think of four or five guys I've known in my lifetime that, you know, at work or, you know, acquaintances, people like that, who just... personify that kind of person where you go, it would just take the right situation to make this guy...
Snap.
Yeah.
Do the wrong thing.
Yeah, yeah. Because they say things and you're just like, ooh, don't say that.
Yeah.
You know, don't talk about, like, you know, Disney Channel girls, like, becoming 18. Right. Like, don't do that. No. Because that means that something gross is happening right now.
Right. Yeah, so absolutely.
I think you should examine yourself and really think about... like where you are as a human being, if that's what it is.
But we also need to examine what's being portrayed in the media.
Absolutely.
We have a lot of over-sexualized little girls on the Disney Channel and every other network and anything out there that has people in focus is showing children as being sexual objects. It's disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of surprising that there's still so much of it. I think that things are probably changing for the better, overall, at least in my lifetime, from where I kind of remember seeing things versus where they are now, but it's, there's still a road.
Yes. And we have, and this is always shocking for people. There are more slaves right now in existence than at any other point in human history. So while we might be seeing some changes in media, we are not seeing changes in humanity.
What do you think the cause of that would be as far as the rise in the numbers? Do you think that it's, the rise of the internet that allows people to connect with each other in such a way that they wouldn't have been able to do before?
That's definitely a lot of it. I mean, a lot of the prostitutes and stuff out there are victims of human trafficking. Their pimps are actually selling them online. Mm-hmm. When I was trafficked the second time, when I was... 31.
Oh, wow.
I was being sold through online dating services like Plenty of Fish. I had no say in the matter, and I have no idea how much money was made off of me being forced into situations I didn't want to be in at all to begin with, and being forced to allow people to rape me up to 20 times a day, 5, 6, 7 days a week.
Yeah.
For 5 months of my life.
And you say, you know, at 31, like you beat the odds in some ways, you know? Yeah, exactly. And came out the other end a survivor. But How do we get to the how do we get to the first one? So you run away. You're young. You're 15.
I started running away at 15. The story of the Miller Miles actually took place when I was 17. I was a senior in high school, and I dropped out of school basically to leave with the guy that I was dating and his cousin, the little 13-year-old girl, and his best friend, who was in his 20s. So I was opened up to this world that I didn't know existed because I had lived such a sheltered life. Nobody talked to me about these kinds of things, about child pornography and about the inappropriate age differences.
Sure.
When my parents met, my mom was 15, my dad was 20. What was that?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and they're still together, last I heard. I don't really talk to them. But there was all these different things being introduced into my life, and my brain at 17 years old didn't know how to comprehend a lot of what I was seeing. When I was 19, I was already married, and I was trying to escape an abusive husband of 38 years old, who was twice my age, and went down to Florida to go and stay with a grandmother. And my parents told her that if she took me in, they'd never speak to her again. So I was left at a bus stop in Daytona Beach, Florida, with $5 in my pocket and nothing to my name. And a couple of strangers, young people, came up and offered me a place to stay. And while I was staying with them, they sold me to somebody else.
Oh, my God.
And I didn't even know it happened.
So you just got picked up, and here we go.
Yeah. And it was a series of unfortunate accidents. And I've had a lot of people ask me, why did this happen? How could my parents do something like this to me? And it was their fault. It's not their fault.
Right.
My parents had no idea something like this was actually going to happen.
Sure.
I'm sure in their heads, they still believe that they did what was best for me at the time, trying to force me back to where I had left.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they would probably say that, but they would also say that I was never a victim of human trafficking, much less twice.
Yeah, that's... Well, and do you think that any of that is denial to save them from a scar?
I think it's a lot of denial based on guilt, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's something that parents, even when they have a complicated relationship with their children, it's... There's always something there where, you know, you see the kid and you're like, this is, you can see a negative manifestation of something or something that goes wrong and you can't help but internalize, yeah, I think I did that. Or, you know, I think some of that is me. You know, I like to say all the time, that based on my experience and what I've seen, it's not really if you're going to fuck up your kids, it's how, you know. So
it's a matter of time, and the clock is ticking.
and you never really know what the thing is going to be. It's going to manifest at some point in the future. You know, you're going to see them doing something and go, oh, okay, yeah, there it is. There it is. All of the wisdom I've tried to impart, it's just, all right, and this is the thing that you remember. This is
right.
This is what happened. You know, the time I forgot to pick you up, or, you know, the time I was playing airplane with you and dropped you. It's like, now you're afraid of elevators. It's like, okay, that's...
Well, I actually do have a similar story of riding a roller coaster with my mother and almost falling out of it upside down.
What?
Yeah. My mother held me in by pulling on the tail of my shirt. It was Montezuma's Revenge at Knott's Berry Farm, and my shoulders were too narrow, and I slid through the shoulder harness. To this day, I'm terrified of glass elevators and anything that is a slow-moving height.
Yeah, of course. Of course you are.
But she saved my life.
Right. But that doesn't matter. I mean, that's, you know, you still know, you know, based on experience, it's like,
yeah, I'm not doing
all
that
right,
again.
Yeah, we're not going to go near glass elevators. And, you know, just best not to risk it.
Mm-hmm.
So you find yourself in this situation. I mean, the obvious question that other people would ask, and I think I understand the answer, but for anyone who's listening who might not, why not run?
Well, the first time I did.
Okay.
Like I said, the couple sold me to somebody before I even knew what was going on. He had me locked up for 23 and a half hours in a very small room with no food, no water, no bathroom. And I knew at that point that my life was on the line.
Yeah.
And that's actually what I talk about in my first book. So when he came back to check on me, I had already... I grew up watching MacGyver.
Yeah.
Richard Dean Anderson will always be my hero, and I've sent him an email thanking him for what he did to help save my life. I've never gotten a response, but I'm holding out hope. But I did everything I could, including building a dummy and finding a place to hide in this small room. And when he came back, he thought I was laying down on the couch sleeping. And he came over to went over to the couch to check on me, and I took off running, and I got out.
Wow.
I did literally run.
Yeah.
But for a lot of these girls, the reason that they don't run is because their families are being threatened. Mm-hmm. These pimps, these kidnappers, these guys, they know. And even if they don't know, they lie to them, make the kids think that they know. They know where their families are. They know where they live. And these kids at 12 and 13 years old, they're being told, if you don't do everything that I say, then your mom is going to die, or your little brother is going to die, and I'll show you his body.
Well, and they're children. I mean, there's a conditioning that's already in place up to a certain point that, you know, you do what the adults say.
Right.
It's the conditioning is there. It's all been put into you from birth.
That's your authority figure.
Absolutely. And even if you're taught to a certain degree, like, you know, stranger danger and things like that.
Oh, this is so much deeper than stranger danger.
How do you go through a situation like this where there's some real consequences? There's some real fear. I mean, it's not the same thing. I would have to imagine as, a creep trying to get you in a van to see a puppy. It's a lot deeper than that.
I got one of those, too.
Oh, really?
When I was 13, a guy offered me candy to come over closer to his car. But when I was 13, I looked closer to 7.
Oh.
Yeah. It started really young in my life. But back to your question... the majority of people that are trafficked by somebody they know.
You know, I remember that from one of my college courses.
Right.
And I remember reading about that. And
it's somebody in your life that you already trust and somebody you love. You know, it's somebody that you've been told is an okay person.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. It's the second time I was trafficked, I'd known the man for 7 years. And I got a fiancé visa to go and live with him in Scotland, to go and be with him for the rest of my life. I gave up my career as a director of security.
Yeah.
I gave up my car, my home. I gave up every sense of stability that I had managed to build for myself over several years. Things that I didn't think that I would ever be able to have. And when I got there, I couldn't run. He took away my passport and I had no money. There was nothing left for me to do.
Yeah.
I had a little bit of money stashed away from selling my car before going over, and I spent what I had in under a month. I spent every penny of that on an emergency plane ticket to get home. But I was already so severely abused by the time that flight date came and went that I had a kidney infection so bad I couldn't walk, much less get to the airport.
Yeah.
So I was subjected to it for another 5 months because there was no way out. I had to, and in some ways I did, I had to pretend that I had Stockholm Syndrome. And I had to trick him into thinking that if he sent me home, I would come back.
Survival.
Yeah, that was exactly it. And I'm a redhead.
Yeah.
So I have this stubborn streak that's a mile wide in me.
Yeah.
I have this survival instinct that I don't think most people have.
Yeah.
And I think there's been several times that that's the only thing that's been able to pull me through. And a lot of these kids wouldn't be able to get through this kind of a situation. I was 31 when that happened to me. Can you imagine a 12-year-old trying to survive that?
Yeah, that's crazy to expect that.
Yeah, yeah.
The interesting thing about all of this, too, is that you know, from a young age, there's all of these almost... touchstones that I'm sure you can look back on now and say, you know, look how early this started. Look at the way that I was able to perceive the people in the world around me
right
up to this point, and to recognize a situation as it arose. And now here you are now, well adjusted.
Thank you.
through everything, through all of this, through everything that's happened, these events that would crush another human being, and you've come out the other side of it and you're able to take all of this that you've been through and hold it up for other people to see and say, look at this. Look what you can get through. And to be able to be some kind of hope for someone, that's got to be helpful. That's got to be empowering as well, to make it feel like everything that you've gone through wasn't for nothing. Right. It was to be able to try to be that, ray of sunshine through the crack in the door for someone.
Right.
And maybe they'll remember and you can be someone's MacGyver. You know?
That would be nice. I would love to be someone's MacGyver. When I first started doing this and talking about my own story, one of the things that I kept saying was that I was tired of living in a nightmare.
Yeah.
And if I had to live through something this brutal, it needed to have a point. It needed to have a purpose in my life, and I needed to find that purpose.
Yeah.
So I found it. I wrote the story. I now do public speaking events and talk about human trafficking and about my own story in order to help to inspire other people to get involved with the fight and to find ways that they can help these organizations that are out here desperately needing people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I don't think that it gets enough coverage.
It doesn't. It's because it's scary. People don't want to look at it if it's scary.
Yeah. It's almost like it's too big.
It is.
You know, if you look at the stories that are on the news, they almost seem solvable. You know, just about everything. But
right.
Once a problem reaches, and there's a word for it, and I'm blanking on the word, but there is a condition that human beings seem to have where once a problem is too big, it's almost like you have no choice but to ignore it.
Right.
And I think that this definitely falls in that category.
Well, it was Stalin during World War II who said, one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic.
Yes. And that's precisely it. It's that kind of thing. When you talk about people, like there was a study done about starving children in Africa. And the study that was done was if you show a little girl and you say, this is the little girl, this is her experience, this is her life. She's starving, she's impoverished, and she's going through all of these things. Will you help? Charitable donations flood in.
You can identify with a single person. You cannot identify with a million.
The moment you give that little girl a brother, the donations go down.
Yeah. I don't want to feed two kids.
You know what I mean? And they found that was shocking. You know, oh, well, she's not alone now.
Yeah.
So
at least she's got company.
Yeah, so the donations pull back.
Right.
And that's a startling statistic.
Yeah.
But if you take that and you expand it exactly like you said, it's a village.
Right.
Now it's a community.
Now
there's thousands of people.
Now it's too big of a problem for me to be able to tackle, so what good would I do?
Yes, exactly. But people fail to realize that it's, you know, much like that village, suffering is 1,000 individuals, our own personal relationships and villages are built on individuals and individuals contributing. That's what it is. If everybody throws in, 98 cents for some clean water and some rice, you got a mountain of rice and an ocean of clean water.
Right.
It's just how it works. But it takes enough people to say, yeah, I don't know if this is going to help, but I'm going to try.
Right.
And I think that this is definitely one of those causes that it doesn't get enough traction because it seems too horrible and too big.
Well, and so many people, charitable organizations over the last couple of decades have really gotten a bad rap.
Yeah.
A lot of them they seem to be scams.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you send $10 to this organization that's going to feed a homeless or a starving child in Africa, and that kid might see 3 cents out of that $10.
Yes.
You know, it's moments like that that you start to think, I sent them $10 of my money, and this kid got 3 cents. If I sent them $100, the kid would get $3 for food.
Yeah.
Where is my money going?
Right.
And that's one of the things that I've really looked into with some of the organizations that I'm working with here in Denver about fighting human trafficking. One of them is Covered in Feathers. pretty much every penny that they get, they don't pay their employees, their workers. Those people are volunteers, and they do a phenomenal job. And every penny that they get goes to the kids that are rescued from trafficking in order to help them get an actual education, because so many of these kids don't go to school when they're trafficked.
Yeah.
They get housing. They get counseling and therapy. They get all of this stuff that, honestly, that I didn't get when I escaped. I didn't have help when I got away, and I didn't have anybody to turn to. Every time I tried to tell somebody what had happened to me, I was called a liar.
Yeah.
These kids don't have to face that. And that's the wonderful thing about Covered in Feathers and Shift Freedom. These guys, they're out there actually helping the kids. They're not making money off of this.
Yeah.
You know, and you just have to vet the groups and figure out which ones are actually doing the work.
It can be a little tough, too, especially if you start getting into anyone that deals in international things, because there are a lot of times when money is going to pay bribes to make sure things get through the borders.
That's exactly.
And so that's where a big chunk of the money is going. It's like, it's and that can make things difficult as well, because how do you explain that to the shareholders? Well, not shareholders, but the public, you know, like, how do you explain that to people? Like, well, we have to do some shady things to try to help people. It's, you know, we have to deal with these bad people in order to subvert these bad people.
Right. And that's one of my favorite things about an organization that's based out of Utah but is an international company. It's called Operation Underground Railroad. Mm-hmm. It's started by Tim Ballard, who is a former Navy SEAL. He was tired of going overseas and seeing these kids that were begging to be rescued from these situations and knowing that he couldn't go back to help them because the government wouldn't allow him. So now he started his own company. Since he's no longer working for the United States government, it's not one government working with another government. It is a private group that is going in, and they've pretty much put a stop almost 100% to all human trafficking in Cartagena. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
In several of these raids, they've taken down, you know, dozens of traffickers and saved up to 50, 60 kids at a time.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I saw a documentary short about an organization headed up by a woman in the Middle East, and I wish I could remember the name of it. It was about 2 years ago that I watched this, and what she was doing was actually raising the money from all sorts of sources, wherever she could get it from, to buy the freedom of these girls. Because she couldn't fight.
Right.
And so it was the only way. The only way was, I'm going to buy these girls. I'm going to purchase them for what their fair market value is.
Right. It's exactly it.
Yeah.
And if you think about the Civil War, that was one of the things that we were battling back then. Not just the separation of the nation.
Yeah.
But there were people from the North who believed in freedom who were traveling down south and purchasing African-American slaves and carrying them up north and saying, okay, now you're free.
Yeah.
You know, and it's something that doesn't stop. Yeah. And we need more of that. But not everybody has the kind of money to be able to pay fair market value for a human being's life. And
yes.
You know what my life was worth in 1999, the first time I was taken?
No.
Take a wild shot in the dark. This is always fun for me.
Okay. 1999.
Okay.
Where were we? I'm trying to think of... Okay. Set the scene. Okay. I'm going to say... let's say... $5,000? $10,000?
Okay. Now take the number that's in your head.
Okay.
And think, I'm a redhead. Redheads are less than 2% of the world's population, so in a lot of areas, we're seen rare. As exotic. Yes. So, does that alter the number in your head?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Okay. It goes up.
Okay. Now, how would you feel if I told you that it's considerably less than that by a couple of zeros?
That's shocking.
Yeah. An entire human life is worth about $80.
Wow.
My life was worth $90. Because I had red hair.
That's insane.
I was sold by a young couple by the name of Adam and Jenny to a young man by the name of Esteban for $90. My entire life. I probably would not have lived another 7 years. And a person in human trafficking can make up to $500,000 a month for their trafficker.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
To think that it's that desperate, that it's that easy.
And these are the numbers that you're not hearing. These are the numbers that nobody's talking about.
Right. Again, it's too big, it's easier to ignore. Right. But when you take it down to, you know, a single human life.
Right.
You know, under $100.
Right. Can buy you a person.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just recently, at the end of February, I went to a Shift Freedom convention, mm-hmm. where a bunch of different organizations and people that fight trafficking all get together. I was slated to be up on the stage after lunch. I was going to talk about my own story, answer a couple of questions, and have my own portion. I knew several people that were there that day. I had friends in the crowd. But when I went in there early in the morning, I made sure that I picked out a seat that was not around anybody that I knew. And it's exactly for that reason, because I wanted to make more of an impact. So when I was sitting there all the way up until lunch, I was quiet. I didn't know anybody. I didn't worry about trying to get to know anybody. I just had my own little time, my own little space. I was just very silent. And when I came out on stage from behind the curtains, when I walked out on stage, I looked at my little empty seat with my coat holding my spot. And I looked at all the faces of all the people that had been sitting around me, and every one of them were shocked. You never know who the person is that's sitting next to you. You never know what their story is, what they've been through, what they're going through, what they're going to go through.
Yeah.
And that impact, when I got done and I went back to my seat, almost every single one of those people touched me on the shoulder and thanked me for having the bravery to get up there and to do it. But it wasn't me. You know, I'm a religious person. That was God. God gave me the strength to get up there. And if he wasn't in my life, I wouldn't have the strength to do 90% of what it is that I'm doing.
Did you ever see any justice for any of this?
No. As far as I know, Esteban is still out there. If you read all the way through the book, you will see right at the very end, I am getting away. He is being pursued by the police, but I don't follow up. I was terrified. I was a 19-year-old kid. I didn't want to know. I turned my head, and I left behind several other girls that I don't know if they're dead or alive. I don't know if they got away. I don't know if they ever caught Esteban. No idea.
So you really needed to just escape all of it?
Yeah.
Just, I need to be out of here. I need to be done.
Right. Yeah. And then I end up putting myself in the situation again at 31 years old, trusting somebody after 7 years.
Yeah. But that's a behavior that... I mean, I can relate to that, and it does make sense to me. You know, I've known people who've gone through a sexual assault, and their first thought isn't, I should go to the hospital and get a rape kit done.
I can't tell anybody.
Yeah, it's I need to go take a shower, and I need something normal, right, to get this off of me, because I can't face the reality that this thing just happened to me. And then, of course, you eventually have to confront that reality. And come out the other side of it.
And so many people don't.
Yeah, absolutely. I was involved in an assault myself, and that was exactly how I dealt with it. Right. It was, I can't do anything with this.
Right.
It's the only thing I can do with this is take a shower and breathe and figure out where I'm going to bury the body of this memory.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
But you can't.
You're angry.
It comes out. It finds ways to interact with you in your day-to-day life.
Well, the emotions that you go through when you deal with something like a single assault is very similar to the emotions that you go through over a period of time when you're being trafficked. So at first you're angry and you're confused. You have no idea what's going on. And then you grow more angry, and then you start to blame yourself. And you start to feel guilty.
Yeah.
And then you wonder, what if I turn off my emotions? What if I turn it off like a light switch and I don't feel anything anymore? Can I do that? And it becomes your ray of hope to not feel. And that's when it really starts to get scary, because you go down this slippery slope and sometimes there's no returning.
Yeah, and the idea that, you know, the way that most people have to go through an individual assault would be, you know, the stages that anyone would have to go through with any kind of trauma. You know, you take it, you eventually have to confront it, and then you have to start, you know, pulling out the wiring that it started to insert inside you and your thought processes and your relationships with other human beings, your relationships with yourself, everything you know about the world. You have to start putting yourself back together because you've been rewired now.
Right.
And so in a situation like yours, where it's not just an individual one, how do you, at the end of all of that, how are you expected to say, you know, I had no time for healing while this happened over and over again? You just have the beginning part of the part where it's the self-worth and the hope and everything is just being taken away and chipped away at time after time. And then you come out of it. What does the road back to normalcy look like for you?
For me, it's been really weird. For a long time, there was a lot of denial, a lot of not being willing to talk about it or to put myself back there mentally. Mm-hmm. But I was still severely dealing with PTSD. I would constantly look in my rearview mirror and think somebody was following me. Occasionally it actually did happen, but that's another story. I put on a lot of weight because I saw that as a self-defense mechanism. Everybody wanted me when I was thin and pretty.
Yes.
Nobody wants me when I'm a big girl.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm on the road to recovery even from that now, because a lot of that piled on once I finally started being able to talk about my story, because I had to put myself back into that traumatic state in order to write the book and to talk about what had happened. And the first couple of times, every time I sat down to talk about it, I would shake and cry.
Yeah.
And the road to recovery for me is being more open about what happened. Every single time I talk about it, I'm feeling better and more confident in the fact that it's not my fault. And
yeah.
That's the hardest thing for a victim to ever admit.
Yeah.
And I am no longer a victim. I am now a survivor.
Yes. And you know, I empathize with that, because even in my own struggles with, you know, depression and suicide and, you know, survival of assault and things like that, even looking at those things from the perspective of where I've been with it, I still have bits and pieces once in a while that'll come back, you know, like little shards of glass under the skin that you forgot were there that make me go, but did you though?
Right.
Did you come out the other side okay? Was it not your fault?
And that's one of the things that I think we all deal with, is that when something traumatic happens, it's not just, oh, that happened. And
yeah.
A lot of people want to think about it that way. I've had very good friends of mine that I've lost as friends who have told me, you need to stop talking about it. Because no. My talking about it is helping other people. And if I have to scream it from the rooftops, I'm going to continue doing that because it means that I can help somebody else.
Yeah.
It's not about me.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to me, and I have to live with that, and it will come back, and it will haunt me, and I will still have the occasional nightmares where I wake up screaming in a cold sweat.
Yeah.
And I can still feel a knife on my throat. But then there's those other days when I wake up, and I'm smiling, and I'm happy, and I've got cats that are cuddling me that love me just so much. And I've got supportive, wonderful people in my life. I've got amazing friends that know what I've been through, and they don't care. They love me anyway. And if I do have a hard time, and I do start to shut down emotionally, and I've been known to do this, I isolate myself for a few months.
Yeah.
Months. And when that happens, most of them, if they know me well enough, most of them understand exactly what's going on. And all they do is reach out once in a while. Hey, you doing all right? Hey, have you got time for coffee? Do you want to go hang out somewhere? You want to go do something nice and quiet? Can I come visit you? How's your new book coming? And I just check in.
Yeah.
If they know me, if they really love me, that's all they do. They don't pressure me. They don't bother me. They don't come up. Nobody shows up at my place unannounced, ever.
Yeah.
They'll have a door slammed in their face if they do.
I could imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the person who's been through, you know, traumatic experiences with other human beings might have a little bit of a problem with surprises.
Right. Well, back a few months ago, I actually had somebody that I knew casually because of an event that I did last year. He showed up at the event, and we got to know each other and got to talk. He lived out in Nebraska. Got a text message from him. We kept in touch.
Yeah.
Saying, hey, are you working tonight? Yes. Well, where are you working? I'm working at the restaurant. I had a part-time job at a restaurant. So then he hits up my best friend and asks her, what's the name of the restaurant where she works? I didn't think much of, well, she didn't think much of it. She just didn't respond. I didn't know that that had happened.
Yeah.
And then I get another text message from him at 2:30 in the morning saying, I'm parked outside. Are you going to let me in?
No.
I didn't see this until 8 in the morning. I called the police the first thing I did.
Yeah.
You don't show up at my house uninvited and unannounced. Yeah.
You know, no one should do that to anyone ever anyway.
No.
That's being outside someone's place at 2:30 in the morning saying, you up? You
know, right.
That's not okay.
Well, I worked until almost midnight, and then I had to get up at 8 o'clock in the morning because I was supposed to take part in a parade with, I'm a part of a charity group called the Battling Betties. We're a bunch of pinup girls that go around and show our retired military a bunch of support and
nice.
You know, love, and it's super cool.
That's awesome.
It was going to be my first real event with these guys, and I couldn't go because I was terrified to walk out of my house.
Yeah.
Don't show up at my door uninvited.
So how do you manage these things as they come up now? I mean, it was therapy ever a thing for you? Did you see a therapist at all?
Well, I have a weird relationship with therapy.
Okay.
When I was 15, my mother put me on Ritalin when I was 4.
Oh, okay.
Illegally.
Yeah.
When I took myself off at 15, I did it without them knowing. They thought I was severely depressed and, you know, going to commit suicide. Basically, what was going on was I was having drug withdrawals.
Yeah.
Yeah, at 15.
And Ritalin's a mother.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I was determined, and I did it. And they were so convinced that I was suicidal that they started taking me to the on-base, I call them shrink.
Yeah, yeah.
This one was a shrink. Not all of them are. But the shrink prescribed Klonopin and Paxil and Prozac and a bunch of other crap that I really did not need.
Yeah, yeah.
So I started flushing those down the toilet every day, too. And the one day that I did actually take the medication, it was because I was severely angry at my parents. And then they called me upstairs to have a discussion with them over something that I hadn't even done. Something I was in trouble for yet again. And at this point, they'd taken everything away except for my mattress and sheets. I didn't even have a door on my bedroom. Everything was gone. I had no bookshelf, nothing. Nothing was there. So I was sitting there high as a kite on drugs that they prescribed me.
Yeah.
Because the shrink didn't know what to do with someone like me because I wasn't telling them that I took myself off the Ritalin.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't because they would have told my parents because I was an underage kid. Now, so here I am trying to deal with all of this stuff, and they lit into me. I don't even remember what it's about. Like 20 minutes of berating me, and at the very end they asked me, they said, well, we want to know what you're thinking. Really? Remember, I'm high as a kite on drugs. I shouldn't be prescribed.
Yes.
And they said, yes, really. And I told them, I said, well, you've taken everything away from me. You've taken away my music, my clothes, my bed, my books, my keyboard, my music, my singing, any extracurricular activities. You've put me in the alternative school for troubled kids. You've taken me out of my high school. Other than hitting me, there is nothing more you can do to me. You have tried so hard to break my spirit, and you never will. And for the first time in my life, I stood up for myself, and I got up, and I walked away from that table. They stopped taking me to the shrink.
Uh-huh.
They didn't give anything back, of course, and things actually somehow did get worse at the house, including having to scrub trash cans with, like, toothbrushes. But, you know, the outside dumpster trash cans.
Oof.
Yeah, nasty. But I was able to, for once, stand up for myself, and I started to get back a little bit of my own strength. I stopped going to the shrink, and from then on, I didn't trust shrinks.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of people now that will listen to me if I'm having a hard time, but my therapy, more than anything, is writing. I get it all out of my system. And when I am able to write down a story and put as much gritty, nasty, dirty detail in it as humanly possible,
yeah,
I let it out of my system and it goes away.
So you just process.
Yeah.
You just decided, I'm just going to do this.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Where do you get that from? I'm just curious. I find that fascinating, you know, because I always love when people start figuring out the tools that they're going to need to get themselves forward right. on their own. You know, I always find that really fascinating because for a number of years, I did the same thing. It was just, you know, well, what I've been doing up to this point has not worked.
Right.
So I'm going to try some other things.
It's got to change. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of it I think is pretty intuitive if you just make the decision that you want to fix something.
Right.
Once you're in that mindset, you don't need someone telling you how to do it. If you can actually get to a point where you're honest with yourself, you'll know if you're making the right decisions.
Right. Absolutely.
Most of the time.
Yeah. So writing came very natural to me at a very young age. I was kind of pushed more towards art for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was about 3 years old, I was drawing a rainbow on a piece of paper. And my mother came out and she said how pretty it was and that someday I was going to be her little professional artist. And I did grow up to do that professionally for a long time. I specialized in photorealism with colored pencils. I still do it from time to time, but that was never where my heart was.
Yeah.
Everybody kept telling me that I was so good at it, that this was a God-given gift and I needed to do more with it. And I got so burned out that finally I just gave up on it. And it's like, you know, I need to return to my real passion. My real passion is writing.
Yeah.
So when I started to write, I started with watching the movie Julie and Julia, which is about...
Yes.
The, yeah.
I love that movie.
It's a great film. But she starts a blog and it helps change her life. So that's what I decided to do. I started a blog. And when it first started, I was so excited about it. You know, every now and then you get somebody that gets something started, a new artistic project or something, and they give up on it after about a month or so.
Yeah.
I kept on going.
Yeah.
It was every single day. So I turned it into the 365 project, where every single day I was writing another blog entry, and most of them were memories from childhood. And after I would write about this very vivid memory, it would fade. And it was like this awakening within me where it's like, all right, so this happens to the good stuff. Does this happen to the bad stuff too? So I started writing about some of the bad memories, and those started to fade. And it was just kind of this, they didn't go away. They were still there.
Right,
but they weren't as intense.
They didn't hurt as much anymore.
Right. And I have a nearly photographic memory, so you can imagine that would be a major curse in a life like mine.
Oh, yeah.
So I started writing about these intense moments in my life, and things started to get better for me, and I was releasing some of this anger. But I was also, with the very descriptive writing that I do, I was delving into my own psyche and understanding why I was reacting certain ways to certain things that were current in my life based on things that had happened previously. I became my own psychologist through my writing.
Yeah. And I think that's something that can only work if you're willing to be that honest with yourself.
Right. Because, and that's a big thing.
Yeah, because if you're not honest with yourself and you try to be your own psychologist, you're going to lead yourself to some pretty bad places.
Right, that's exactly it. And
like, you know, it'd probably be good for you to just stay in bed or maybe take these pills or, you know, let's drink all day.
Yeah, exactly. But circling back on the pills and back on my childhood, Ritalin, one of the side effects of having a child on Ritalin at such a young age is the inhibition factors.
Mm-hmm.
As adults, eventually their inhibitors start to break down.
Yeah.
I'm so open about everything that I've been through because of everything that I've been through.
Yeah.
The Ritalin caused me to not have a filter.
Yeah.
I have no problem telling anybody about my time in human trafficking or any of the nitty-gritty details. Some people don't necessarily want to hear it. That doesn't mean I'm not willing to share it.
Right. So. Yeah, so, you know, it could ruin Thanksgiving, but, you know.
What's that? Yeah, I don't have any family anymore, so Thanksgiving is usually sitting down and eating some turkey breast with my significant other.
Well, the difference is you get to pick your family now.
That's very true. Yeah. And, you know.
You always could, right? You know, but it's kind of empowering to come to the realization that, you know, the people that are in your life are there because you want them there.
Right. When I was living in LA, I had a family that lived in Michigan who would fly out and spend time in their summer home in Ventura, and they'd be up there for usually a couple of weeks around the holidays. And they always invited me, and I would take time off work. I would go up and I would spend the holidays with them, and it was the most peaceful, most realistic family holiday I've ever spent in my entire life. Was with the Arnold family. They are incredible. My brother Patrick is just beyond amazing. We're both redheads, so everybody thinks we're actually siblings anyway. But out here, I have the Sussman-Weissman clan.
Yeah.
They're actually mentioned as a thank you in my latest book. They've really extended themselves to me. They are my family now. It's Colette and David and Rory. And their little girl, Rory, is she's 12, and she's autistic. She's got cerebral palsy. She was a 23-week preemie. She nearly didn't survive. And this little girl is one of the most inspirational people I've ever met in my entire life, and also one of the most positive, loving people.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you are tempered in the fires of your own challenges, you're going to come out one of two ways.
Right.
So, you know, luckily, with the right guidance and the right help, you can come out strong, and you can come out swinging.
Oh, Colette's an incredible mother.
So, yeah. Well, that's awesome.
Rory's just a really, really super cool kid.
This is absolutely wonderful. This has been an amazing conversation. I have about a million questions that I don't even know what they are yet. But I feel really grateful that you came by to talk to me today.
I'm glad you reached out twice.
Well, I really wanted to have this face to face. It's a fabulous story, and I thank you for sharing it with me.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, what an incredible story, am I right? If you want to know more about that story, you can find it in her book, Detailed Pieces of a Shattered Dream, One Kidnapped Victim's Hair-Raising Escape, Told in Her Own Words. You can find Amanda Blackwood on Amazon. You can get the new book, Twisted Fate, which has got poetry for every mood and every occasion. Much like the poem that I read at the beginning of the show. She's got a ton of other books. She's got a ton of other stuff. And if you look in the feed below in the show notes, you can find all kinds of other places to see Amanda, because she is everywhere. As for me, I will be back next week with another guest and another story to tell. So until then, don't kill yourselves out there.